whittle. I whacked that whack-a-mole this morning. You are in the Senate Education and General Government Committee. Welcome. We have a couple of rules. We go over every committee, but some of you have flown from someplace to be at this committee. So I'll remind you, we have no cell phone rule in here, so turn it off, please. If you've got a cell phone, PDA, anything that makes noise, turn it off. If I hear it, I'll ask you to make a generous contribution to the Common School Fund that funds our state schools. Okay, just to give you all a heads up where we're going this morning, I had allocated an hour for Senate Bill 614, and the other three bills are kind of short. So what I'm going to do is take those three bills first, and then that way if we have more than an hour for 614, we can do that. So with that, Athena just walked in the room. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 747.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 747 requires a licensee who conducts race meets for horses to maintain a cash vouchers account. It requires periodic payment from this cash vouchers account to the Horsemen's Association for benevolent purposes. You also have in front of you a Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 1 amendment specifies the percentages of payments to identified horse racing associations in addition to the Horsemen's Association, and it adds educational programs as permissible uses of the payments. It also updates statutory references to the Oregon Thoroughbred Owners and the Breeders Association Oregon Quarter Horse Racing Association.
Terrific. Thank you, Ms. Richardson. Ms. Zeke, I have you on my list. You ready? Last time you had to wait and wait and wait. Today you get to go first.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're
welcome.
I
also have a voice today. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Athena Zeke. I'm a lobbyist with the Oregon Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association, and we are here in support of Senate Bill 747. You have in front of you an outline of what we propose Senate Bill 747 with the Dash 1 amendments do. I'll answer any questions you have on that. On the second page, I made a small chart to help understand how the this is really simplified, but this is kind of how the money moves through the system with the betting and the cash vouchers and the winning ticket and how you can get your money back out. We actually have some cash vouchers for the committee to look at.
Okay. Do you want to hand those to Ms. Gravel? She can share them with us.
And we'd also like to point out on the third page of our handout that we just thought we'd give you a real quick run through of what our benevolence program does. And my cohort here, Dick Cartney, could speak to that a little bit if you have some questions on that.
Okay. Before we get to that, Ms. Zeke, why don't you take us through what the bill does? I mean, I'm sure you visited with all of us, but those out in TV land don't know what we're talking about today. So just tell me when someone goes to the track, what happens and what it is that you're trying to do here.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 747-1 would create a statute. This is an entirely new statute that would address cash vouchers, which are printed paper tickets that have a cash, they're redeemable for cash.
And so like this that, in my hand now.
Yes, in your hand.
This is worth 30 cents.
Exactly.
Some well, people. Worth $300,000. It could be any amount.
Wait a minute. I'm the chair of this committee.
I'm going with him.
All right. So you get a credit voucher.
You can take that credit voucher and you can use it in a self-service machine. You can get it from a self-service machine or a live mutual clerk. And then you have the ability to put it back in the machine or take it back to the live mutual clerk to print a betting ticket for your wager on the horse race. And let's say, obviously, if you lose, you're done. Money's gone. You have to start over. But if you win, you can redeem that winning ticket for either your cash. You can place a new bet. And if you have leftover money or you just simply want your cash, you can either go to a live mutual teller, clerk, and get your cash back dollar bills in hand or a new betting ticket, or you can go to the self-service machine and place a new bet or get a new cash voucher. The self-service machine does not hand out cash. You have to go to the live clerk for that.
Okay.
And what the horse groups are looking for is the unclaimed cash vouchers, which are the ones that go through the washing machine in your pocket, or the 30 cents. Some people just don't care. They're not going to keep a stack of 400 of those to eventually cash, and they'll toss them in the garbage. So there's just some vouchers unclaimed floating around out there, and we'd like to claim them for benevolence and educational programs.
And Mr. Carton is going to tell us about those programs then.
Yes.
Right? Okay. Can you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Dick Cartney. I'm the executive director of the Oregon HPPA. Senator Walker and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. We are a nonprofit benevolent organization. We have about 1,500 members. And part of our mission as an organization is to provide benevolent programs for our members. We also have programs for their, not only the owners and trainers, but their immediate family and their employees. A lot of the folks that work directly with the horses are low-income folks, and some of them don't have a lot of skills, and they don't have insurance and that sort of thing. So we try to do the best we can with our limited amount of funds that we have available to help them make their lives a little bit better. And some of the things we do is we have a dental program, which provides a certain amount of benefit yearly for each member. We have a vision program. We have a scholarship program, which we're very proud of. I think we have three people on scholarship right now. We also have a drug and alcohol counselor who comes in on a part-time basis and helps with folks that may have issues on that along that line. We do a number of other things. Someone has a hardship case, they're sick or ill, and they can't work for a period of time. We will help pay some of their bills as much as we can. We're kind of limited with the funds that we have available, but we try to do as the best we can with what we have. And that's one reason why this bill is very important to us, because it will give us a little bit more resource to help these folks as best we can.
Okay. Ms. Zeke, how much money are we looking at potentially here?
The folks that run the Portland Meadows track have told us the initial payment, because it's been accruing for some years, would be between $200,000 and $250,000, and that would be divided among the three groups. And then after that, they projected $18,000 to $20,000 a year, but it's hard to tell until we have that year-long space. The whole horse program, racing program, goes like this, as you well know. And sometimes people are out there betting and using the system, and sometimes they're not so much.
Okay. Let me ask this final question, then I'll open up to the committee. When someone has one of these unclaimed vouchers and doesn't use it, someone has to list this as a liability out there. How long is this held as a liability until it will be paid over to the fund?
Through the bill or as we are now?
Well, as we are now and then through the bill.
Senator, Chair Walker, members of the committee, it's my understanding that they have to hold it for 7 years, and then it becomes unclaimed property, and at that point it becomes property of the state. And I'm not sure exactly where it goes at that point, but since it's almost cash, I would assume it go right to the general fund. The way we would like to do it with the bill is the ticket holder, voucher holder, would have 180 days, which would give them from the close of the live race meet in April or beginning of May, depending on their schedule, can clear until the next time they come back to Portland Meadows and get into the next race meet. So they'd have plenty of time to use that voucher in the system. And if they haven't cashed it by then it would be, the liability would be held in a cash vouchers account. And I believe it was 210 days after that 180 days, the money is to be paid to the three horse groups.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense to me. Question, Senator Westman?
I mean, just a small clarification. The unutilized funds go to the Division of State Lands, Unclaimed Property, and there they stay in corpus to produce interest for the Common School Fund. They do not, as an aggregate, go to the general fund.
That's right.
And I think it might be 3 years. I'm looking at Inga back there. Yeah, but...
But it never does become...
Right.
Yeah. And that's why I always ask people to make a generous contribution to the Common School Fund if they don't turn off their cell phone in here, because we can use all the money we can get. Any other questions? All right, anything else from either of you? You're the only ones scheduled to testify.
No, if there's no questions, Chair Walker, we're happy. Please vote yes.
All right. Thank you very much. You did a great job. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 4747. Committee, I'm going to open a work session unless I hear any growling. Okay, I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 747. We have an amendment, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment to what could be called the airplane bill, but we'll call it 747.
All right. Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 747. Any discussion about that? Any objection? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 747 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 747 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? You want to call the roll, Ms. Gravel? We haven't done that in a while.
Senator
Lester? Aye.
Senator
Moore?
Aye.
Senator Westheim?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 747 has the votes. We'll send it to the floor. Who would like to carry that bill? Senator Morris, have you carried anything in a while?
Oh, no, he hasn't, Matt.
He has not at all.
No, he should not carry anything.
I'm going to assign this to you.
I would be honored to do
it. I'd do it to Senator Metzger, but he wasn't here for the presentation.
Oh, but I've had this presentation.
I'm sure you have. All right. We will move along to our next bill, see how quickly that worked this morning. Senate Bill 615, I'll open a public hearing. Ms. Richardson, what's going on there?
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 615 grants the Metropolitan Service District jurisdiction over boundary changes within district boundaries. It eliminates the process for contested boundary changes, requires the Metropolitan Service District to establish a criteria for boundary changes, boundary change hearing and notification process, and uncontested boundary change process.
Okay, I understand this is a Metro bill. And I was told it wouldn't take very long, so Ms. Thorne and Mr. Benner, why don't you come forward?
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
I'm Richard Benner, attorney at Metro, and with me is Jill Thorne. Jill Thorne is a member of the Boundary Appeals Commission, and this bill is about the Boundary Appeals Commission. And Ms. Thorne is former mayor of West Lynn. Let me give you a bit of background on the Boundary Appeals Commission and why we're here. Some of you, I think, will remember when there used to be boundary commissions around the state. And you still have one, I believe.
Well, we're about ready to obliterate it.
I see.
We have a bill in our committee right now, and we've just reached agreement on that, and it will be phasing out over this next year, should my colleagues agree with us. But, yeah, we know about that. We had a hearing on that.
Well, there used to be one in the metro area. There were three, one for the Portland area, one for Eugene-Salem, and one for Salem-Kaiser. And they were in charge of what are called boundary changes, annexations, incorporations, changes of the boundaries of special districts, etc. When Metro was established by voters in 1978, as you might imagine, leaders in the legislature and elsewhere thought, do we still need the Portland Metropolitan Area Local Government Boundary Commission? And I notice in my testimony I gave you a really ugly acronym without telling you what that is. I apologize for that. But that's the Portland Metropolitan Area Local Government Boundary Commission.
We knew that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
So after many years of debate about whether there should still be a boundary commission there, in 1997 the legislature finally abolished it. When it did, thinking that Metro, whose geographic territory was almost the same as the Boundary Commission's territory, could perform at least some of the functions of the old Boundary Commission. So when the Boundary Commission was abolished, our statute was changed to give us some of the functions of the old Boundary Commission, some jurisdiction over boundary changes. And in the bullets there, I give you are the five principal charges made to Metro dealing with boundary changes: a uniform hearing and notification process that cities and counties would use, an expedited process for uncontested boundary changes when nobody was objecting to it, criteria for the changes, a contested case appeal process available only to cities, counties, and special districts, and that's an important point to bear in mind here, and it required us to establish a three-person commission to hear appeals of boundary changes. And then finally, some administrative responsibilities that after a change was made, we're supposed to send records around so everybody can keep track of the boundary change. Since the Boundary Appeals Commission was established by Metro in 1998, there have only been three appeals to it. I'm going to mention only one, a recent one, to illustrate the problem that has arisen and what brings us here in front of you. There were two appeals in 2005. The one that I'm going to talk about was brought by the city of Happy Valley against the new city of Damascus, and it had to do with disputes between the two cities over annexations. Senator Metzger probably remembers reading about them.
You'll hear about it.
Due to uncertainties in the statutes, Happy Valley didn't know whether to go to LUBA, which did have jurisdiction over the boundary change by Damascus, or to come to the Metro Boundary Appeals Commission. The attorney, being careful, went both places, so filed both at LUBA and at the Boundary Appeals Commission. Simultaneously, there were a couple of other appeals in this dispute between City of Happy Valley and City of Damascus. So there were two appeals filed at LUBA, and then the Happy Valley appeal came to the Boundary Appeals Commission. LUBA said, we'll hold off on our decisions and we'll let the Boundary Appeals Commission make its decision in the Happy Valley appeal. And in that case, the Boundary Appeals Commission decided in favor of Damascus. And Happy Valley then appealed the Boundary Appeals Commission decision to LUBA. So then we now had three cases over the same series of annexations at LUBA. The critical holding in the last LUBA appeal, and I attached that case for you to my testimony in case you would want to read it, surprised people quite a bit. It said that before anybody can appeal, before a city, county, or special district can appeal a boundary change to LUBA, it has to come to the Metropolitan Boundary Appeals Commission. And this is what shook things up, because previously, and as conceived, the appeal to the Metro Boundary Appeals Commission was thought of as a less formal way of resolving boundary change disputes. It was like an off-ramp. It's like a way of not going to LUBA. The people who make up the Boundary Appeals Commission are not necessarily lawyers. I mean, it seemed it was intended to be an alternative. But LUBA interpreted our statute and interpreted its own jurisdictional statute in Senate Bill 197 and concluded that because the Metro Boundary Appeals Commission appeal process exists, it must be exhausted before somebody can go to LUBA.
I have one.
So here's where we are now. Instead of this appeals process at Metro being sort of a lesser way of resolving a dispute, an alternative to LUBA, it is now, the law has been interpreted to make it a prerequisite to getting to LUBA. So instead of being an off-ramp or something simpler, it's become just another step in the appeals process. So if you're a city or a county or a special district and you're upset with a boundary change decision made by another city or another county, you have to come to the Boundary Appeals Commission process before you can get the LUBA. And that's what led us to think that maybe the Boundary Appeals Commission had outlived its usefulness, and it would be better, because LUBA has jurisdiction over every issue that could come before the Boundary Appeals Commission. It's really not serving its intended purpose anymore, and it's in fact, it's made things slower. It's added a step to the appeals process. It costs time and money for us and the cities and the counties who participate. So it's we drafted this bill, and the effect of the bill would be to revise our statute. And you remember those five bullets of things that we're supposed to do in the boundary change business. It would eliminate the bullet that says we have to have a contested case process and a three-person appeals commission. That's the change that we're looking for in the law. And
so you're basically getting rid of Ms. Thorne's job.
Right.
That's correct.
Okay.
And it was our treat to have her come down here today. our thanks for her long service on the boundary.
Well, you're helping make the case for why we should get rid of the Lane County Boundary Commission, so I appreciate the testimony this morning. So, Ms. Thorne, why don't you tell us about why you're willing to give up your post?
Okay. Good morning. I'm Jill Thorne, one of the three members of the Metropolitan Boundary Area Appeals Commission. I was a member of the Metropolitan Policy Advisory Committee in 1997 and 98, representing the small cities in Clackamas County when this process was put in place. The Metro Appeals process was intended to be a simpler, less formal alternative to the LUBA appeals process. The membership of the commission is three people who have held elective office, one member from each of the three counties in Metro. Two of us are former mayors, and the third is a former state senator. One of the reasons each member of the Metropolitan Boundary Appeals Commission agreed to serve was because we believed our experience in local and state government would be helpful in the process. We expected that our background and experience would allow us to help resolve disputes over boundary changes. However, what we encountered was a wave of complicated legal issues that obscured the practical and policy issues on which the three of us could bring our experience to bear. Given the nature of the commission appeals and the LUBA ruling that an appeal must be made to the commission as a prerequisite, it doesn't make sense to have this step in the process. That is why the members of the commission support the amendment to Metro statute to remove the requirement to provide this appeal process.
Okay. Well, it's removing another layer of bureaucracy.
Absolutely.
And we're all about government streamlining here. Any questions, Senator Metzger?
Let's go. I like
district?
It.
Okay.
I like it. Streamlining. Going back the way it was.
Not quite.
Well, not quite, but closer.
All right. Any other questions from the committee? If not, I see no other testimony, so I'll close the public hearing. Thank you both for coming down. I appreciate it, and I appreciated your service as well.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing. Excuse me, a little bit of my cold still hanging on. Week 5. Senate Bill 615 will open a work session on Senate Bill 615.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 615 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 615 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any comments or discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just briefly, this makes sense. It's eliminating something that was designed to be an everyman's venue into land use decisions.
And woman, right?
I just find it interesting because that's what LUBA was also supposed to be, and LUBA has turned into a lawyer fest, so we may need to revisit that. LUBA was supposed to be a lower level to the Court of Appeals, and it has basically become almost the Court of Appeals itself. So,
Well, unfortunately,
has nothing to do with the bill.
Yes,
just
fortunately, we are not discussing Luba's charge this morning, but I do appreciate that we are trying what the Boundary Commission was set out to do, and that's what the Lane County Boundary Commission was for as well, but it's just turned into something different. So I hope you remember this testimony when we bring this bill back for work session. My bill, not this one. All right. Seeing no other questions or comments, Ms. Gravel, if you'll take the roll, we'll get this moving.
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 615 passes, and you know, I'm going to give this to you, Senator Cruz, so you can make your little comment about Luba.
Thank you.
All right, we'll move right along. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 773.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 773 removes references to the Metropolitan Service District and provisions applicable to districts generally that conflict with or are superseded by more specific provisions that are applicable to the Metro Service Districts.
Okay. We have one person signed up, Paul Garan. Garahan. These new glasses I'm not used to yet.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. You got it just right. It's Paul Garahan.
Okay.
I'm also an attorney with Metro. Senate Bill 773 is essentially, we see it as a housekeeping bill. A little bit of background before I describe what the bill does. As I'm sure you're aware, Metro was originally a creation of the state, of the legislature exclusively, was a special district as a metropolitan service district, and has evolved over time. As a special district, originally, ORS Chapter 198, which creates some of the basic provisions under which special districts can operate, like rules for them adopting resolutions and ordinances, applied to Metro. In addition, there was a separate chapter of the statutes, ORS Chapter 268, which applied specifically to Metro. And established similar rules about how Metro operates. Over the years, the legislature saw fit to amend the rules under which Metro operated, and so ORS Chapter 268 was amended several times. And then the voters in 1990, the voters of the state, passed a constitutional amendment to give the voters of the Metro region the right to adopt their own charter. And in 1992, the voters of the Metro region adopted a charter for Metro, making Metro a home rule entity with authority to act under its charter on matters of metropolitan concern as determined by the Metro District and the Metro Council. And so Metro is now a very different creature as a home rule chartered metropolitan service district. What has happened is that some of the provisions of ORS Chapter 198 still read to include Metro, the Metropolitan Service District, and define it as a special district, even though there are more specific provisions in ORS Chapter 268 on the same topics, and also provisions in the charter, Metro Charter, on the same topics. And what this does as a result is that reading ORS Chapter 198 in isolation leaves the confusing impression that its provisions apply to Metro. So there are more specific provisions elsewhere, but some confusion has arisen when folks have looked at ORS Chapter 198 and wondered about its provisions and why there's a conflict. And so this bill is actually, if you will, an extension of a bill that was adopted by the legislature in 1997. At that time, House Bill 3638 was adopted with a specific purpose to conform ORS Chapter 268 and other state laws to the 1992 Metro Charter. And Metro submits that these were a couple specific provisions of state law that were overlooked at that time. And so this just clarifies for these specific sections of ORS Chapter 198 that they they no longer apply to Metro. There are, I've provided on the back of my testimony there a summary of the primary substantive sections. I'd be happy to answer any questions about those. I will note one item. I know that Metro's lobbyist, Randy Tucker, had spoken with Senator Cruz, and he raised one question in about sections 5 and 6 of Senate Bill 773, because it appears that the Port of Portland is being added into the bill, defining it as a special district. In fact, that's just a matter of the legislative drafting. There were, in the current statutes, there are two sections, in each of those places, there are two sections with definitions, one a general definitions and one a specific section that is defining district for purposes of those statutes. And legislative counsel, when we brought this proposal to them, realized this was an opportunity to correct that little anomaly and just have one definition section. And what that required is, in taking us out of the definition, when they moved that definition into the other section, the Port of Portland had to get moved. So you'll notice in Section 9 that two sections are repealed. Those are those old anomalous definition sections. And then that the other provisions of those are moved into the other sections as noted in Sections 5 and Section 6. So it's not a change with respect to the port or other any other entity. And I'd be happy to answer any questions about that.
Okay, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, and thank you for that clarification. I guess one of my concerns, because it does specifically reference Port of Portland, that we are somehow not inadvertently leaving the other ports out. And I'm assuming, since LC did this, that would not be the case. But for us to suddenly not have the other ports as part of special districts, I think would be a mistake. And I thank you for the explanation. Just a concern.
Okay. You okay, though?
I'm okay. Madam Chair, my sense at this point is that we're probably okay, that other ports are well taken care of, and if not, we'll make sure that that's addressed. But
okay.
I mean, it just, Madam Chair, just kind of a red flag when I saw Port of Portland as a standalone, and I understand it's a completely different entity from other ports. But the other ports are also important economic interest in their particular parts of the state, and I just want to make sure that they're not excluded inadvertently. So,
response,
and Randy will.
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, this bill doesn't change how either the port or any other port is treated. It leaves the exact same definitions that were in place prior. It's just moving the definition to another location. So I can't speak for the ports, obviously, but I suspect if they haven't raised an issue about whether they should be defined here, then perhaps there is not one, but I understand.
Okay. Yeah, and Madam Chair, I'm not suggesting necessarily that there is. I just know, due to my service on the Judiciary Committee this session, that sometimes when we do cleanups or reorganization, things get inadvertently dropped, because we do a lot of bills to make those corrections over things that were missed in a previous session. So that was, if I was not on Judiciary, this might not have occurred to me.
Serving on that committee does raise
it's a lot. It's an education, that's for sure.
All right, any other questions from the committee? All right, thank you, Mr. Garahan. I appreciate it. You were the only person signed up, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 773. Unless I have any heartburn, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 773.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 773 to the Senate floor with a due-pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 773 to the floor of the Senate with a due-pass recommendation. Any comments, questions, discussion? We're not a very talkative committee yet this morning, but we'll get there. You want to take the vote, Ms. Gravel?
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Senator Wessel?
Aye.
Vice Chair?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 773 has the necessary votes to move to the floor. And Senator Metzger, how about you chairing?
Sure, delighted.
Okay, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 773. Senator Westlin, you were out of the room when we took your vote on a bill. Do you want to vote on it?
615.
I would like to...
That's abolishing the Metro Boundary Appeals.
Ask permission of the committee to cast a vote on Senate Bill 615, Madam Chair.
Okay, any objection? Hearing none, how do you vote?
Westlin votes aye.
Okay,
thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. All right, now we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 614. We have an hour and 25 minutes, which will be quite nice. If I'd have been thinking about it in advance, I would have run this committee, this discussion, the way I did Senate Bill 426 with opening and closing arguments, but I didn't think about that in advance, so folks have not been put on notice. So we'll just do it the old-fashioned way. And I'll hear from the proponents, the opponents, and then the folks who are neutral. We've got one neutral party. Okay. That would be Jana Fussell. Oh, here we go. Two lists. Terrific. All right. Well, we're going to start with the proponents first so we know what the heck's going on with this bill as soon as Ms. Richardson tells us a little background.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 614 caps the amount of bond proceeds Oregon Facilities Authority or Hospital Authority may provide to nonprofit healthcare institutions or nonprofit provider of hospital facilities if the institution or provider has a specified amount of cash on hand. It requires healthcare institutions to have a certificate of need to qualify for public financing. It exempts rural hospitals from that requirement. It requires the Oregon Facilities Authority board members to declare actual or potential conflicts of interest based on their relationships with a nonprofit corporation. It requires members of Hospital Authority Board of Directors to declare actual or potential conflicts of interest based on a relationship with a nonprofit corporation and file a statement of economic interest. We have dashed ones before us as well. The Dash One Amendment replaces the term cash on hand with the term available assets. It specifies the operating expenses for 100 out of the previous year's 365 days may be deducted from the institution's available assets. It requires a declaration of conflict of interest for a membership or employment with a nonprofit corporation or foundation whose primary purpose is assisting the nonprofit corporation.
All right, thank you. And colleagues, you'll note you'll have some written testimony. I do see our former colleague, Rob Patridge, has graciously given us a letter, even though he's on vacation. So you might take a look at that. All right, what I want to do is hear from the proponents about the bill, and then I want to hear from the opponents what their position is, and then we'll switch back to the proponents. So Lynn Marie Kreider and Suman Ray are going to lead off for the proponents. Good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Marie Kreider, and I am responsible for public policy, particularly health care policy issues for Service Employees International Union Local 49. My colleague, Suman Ray, works with our capital stewardship program, and he can tell you more about that with our international union. And he's more of an expert than I in capital markets, and so hopefully we'll be able to help you with questions that you may have.
Okay. Is Mr. Ray from out of town?
Yes, I am. I'm from New York.
Okay. Great. You're a long way from home. All right, Ms. Kreider, so you'll take us into the bill first?
Madam Chair, I will. SEIU is supportive of the bill. We believe that some amendments will be required based on our conversations with a number of folks in the hearing room today. The dash ones, I think, were an attempt to solve a couple of issues, one with relating to clarifying the applicability of the statute, that is, to what kinds of facilities, financing of what kind of facilities, and our intention would not be to cover long-term care, assisted living, that kinds of facilities. I'm not sure we're quite there in the Dash ones. I need to have some more conversations with folks. And in addition, there are some drafting issues with respect to some of the ethics pieces and disclosure pieces that have been raised by the treasurer's office, and we do want to solve those issues. So,
okay. So we're not even going to entertain the Dash ones today.
I think that's right. Let's talk about concepts, if that's
okay.
That's satisfactory. SEIU supports the bill because of a number of issues that we believe face the state. One, obviously, the need to slow down the rapid growth in what Oregonians are spending on hospital services and other health care services so that it's actually possible to provide health care for all Oregonians. The cost of health care in Oregon is substantially driven by massive capital investment in new hospital infrastructure, and this deals with one of the key funding mechanisms for that growth. Tax-exempt bonds, which is what is addressed by this bill, make it possible for wealthy hospital companies that to build and expand using low interest loans made possible by the state, while sitting on large investment portfolios that could be used to finance the capital construction. And finally, we believe that it is essential for us to consider very carefully public expenditures that are made in the form of tax expenditures, just as we would an actual spending bill. So that's sort of what we come to this with. Oregonians support hospitals and health systems that operate in our state in a host of ways. We spend more than $6 billion a year in hospitals in this state. Almost 60% of that money is taxpayer money in the form of Medicare and Medicaid dollars. So we have a big stake in those programs. Taxpayers provide additional support for nonprofit hospitals by allowing them to operate without paying federal and state corporate income and excise taxes and local property taxes, and allowing them to solicit donations that are tax deductible to contributors. We believe that is all fine so long as what nonprofit hospitals do with our money makes sense and serves the public interest, and that's what this bill is about. This bill concerns the tax-exempt bonding process. All hospitals pay some of the costs of construction and other capital improvements from reserves and cash flow. But the financially strongest nonprofit hospitals in our state secure low-interest loans in the form of tax-exempt bonds issued by public entities. Those nonprofit hospital companies prefer tax-exempt bond financing to other forms of financing because it costs less than conventional financing. And we can explain that further here. Hospital bonds are issued on behalf of a borrower hospital by the Oregon Facilities Authority. OHSU has the independent authority to issue bonds as a sort of quasi-government entity in itself. And then dozens of municipally created healthcare financing authorities also have the power to issue tax-exempt bonds. The hospitals repay the bonds or the debt from patient services revenue. Although these are revenue bonds, not general obligation bonds, the state of Oregon and the federal government subsidize hospitals that access tax-exempt bond financing to the tune of millions of dollars a year. And that's because when investors choose to put their money in tax-exempt bonds instead of taxable investments, they don't pay taxes on their income. And that, as they would if they were investing in the bank or in corporate securities. So in its tax expenditure report, the Oregon Department of Revenue estimated that tax-exempt bonds cost the state over $71 million during the 05-07 biennium. Now, only a slice of that $71 million is health care bond related, and we estimated that to be in the neighborhood of $10 million a biennium, in the form of state subsidy, in the form of tax expenditures. This bill takes important steps towards making tax-exempt hospital bond financing programs in our state accountable to the public interest and subject to public oversight. Let me go through the three major changes, if I may, that the bill makes. First, the members of healthcare financing authorities would be required under the bill to file statements of economic interest like other public officials. Right now, the members of the Oregon Facilities Authority, which is the statewide authority, are required by statute to file economic disclosure statements, but the municipally created authorities, those members do not file economic interest statements unless for some other reason they're required to. For example, the Multnomah County has established a facilities authority. Its members are the county commission, so they are filing economic interest statements. But most of the other municipally created authorities around the state are not composed of public officials. They're composed of, you know, somebody that works for the local bank, somebody that works for the local hospital, often is on the hospital board or works for the local hospital, and yet those people don't have to file economic disclosure statements. So this bill would say everybody that serves on these boards and has the authority to issue bonds must file disclosure statements. In addition, the Chapter 244, the ethics statute, actually currently includes a statement that those who serve on nonprofit boards and also serve as public officials do not have a conflict of interest if they act on something brought to the agency by their by the nonprofit organization. And so, for example, if a manager of a local or administrator of a local hospital sits on a hospital facilities authority and that hospital makes an application for a bond to that local authority, that individual need not disclose a actual or potential conflict of interest or decline to participate in the discussion. This bill would say hospitals are big business in this state, and to allow folks to participate without disclosing conflicts of interest simply because that hospital operates as a 501c3 organization doesn't make sense. So it makes an amendment to the ethics law with respect to that matter. Secondly, the bill would require a hospital seeking tax-exempt bonds to meet a couple of public interest requirements. One, to establish that the project that they're intending to build with the money, it fills a community need. And two, that to establish that they need the low interest financing in order to do the project. And the way the bill handles those issues is, with respect to community need, the bill says, in order to, as a condition of getting tax-exempt bond financing, you need a certificate of need establishing that the Department of Human Services has found that your project meets a community need in a cost-efficient way, and so on. Right now, the law simply says, tells the authorities that if somebody comes to you, wants to build a hospital facility, and they can repay the debt from revenue, go for it. There is no standard of community need in the statute at this point. As to the current law also does not limit access to taxpayer-subsidized borrowing to hospitals that couldn't undertake the capital project without our taxpayer assistance. And the bill, and as a consequence, what is happening is that of the $2.7 billion in outstanding health care financing that exists right now, half of that goes to four large hospital systems, most of whom have large investment assets. Our view is what this body of law ought to do is to help make available capital to hospitals that are struggling and that couldn't do what we need done in our communities without this. Now, what the bill does is to limit access to tax-exempt bond capital to the companies that have a lot of investment assets. It doesn't do the other piece that we would like eventually to do, and that is to figure out how to truly make tax-exempt bond financing available to small, struggling hospitals, because the reality is that many of them cannot truly access the capital markets right now because the bond rating agencies say, this is garbage. You don't have the financial strength to assure us that you can repay the debt. And eventually, I think, and it may be the next session, but we need to come to figure out some ways to grapple with that piece. I think that rather than say more, I have said more about the formula that we use to determine need in the statute in my written testimony, but I think I'll turn to Shimon Ray, if I may.
Okay, that would be helpful, since we are now about 17 minutes into your testimony. We need to speed it along. Mr. Ray, welcome to Oregon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, one of the things, you know, I don't think the...
I'm sorry, you'll have to state your name for the record,
even
though we all
Shuman,
talked about you.
I'm Shimon Ray.
Okay.
I'm the Director of Public Finance in the SEIU Capital Stewardship Program, and I'm currently a resident of New York. Just a couple of words on the Capital Stewardship Program. What we do is we work with members of pension fund boards and finance authorities to promote best practices and promote the integrity of capital markets. And we're organized along asset class lines, public equities, private equity, real estate, and fixed income, and within that particularly the tax-exempt bonds, and that's what I do. I'll just say one thing. You know, the bill does not actually establish caps. What it tries to do is create a system by which borrowers are encouraged to draw down their investment portfolio and not engage in what's called tax arbitrage prior to accessing the tax-exempt bond market. So actually what the bill does is it establishes minimum floors based on how much investment assets you have minus a cushion of operating expense. And if you have that cushion, what it does is it says then you draw that your investment assets down prior to accessing this market. So that's actually what the bill does versus actually set a cap. I can explain more of that later. But let me just quickly walk through this slideshow. I think all of you have it. It's kind of a 101, and I'll go really quickly through it. Stop me, though, if I speak too fast or if you have any questions. So, you know, why do tax-exempt bonds matter? Here, what we show is basically the sources of capital for nonprofits, for-profits, and government. In the U.S., about 70% of the hospital industry is 501c3 corporations, nonprofits, but another 15% government and another 15% for-profit. The numbers are different state by state, but that's a nationwide number. And what we see if you're a for-profit company, you have several ways you can finance expansion. You have retained earnings, which all three do. For equity, only if you're a for-profit, you have the opportunity to issue stock. You have philanthropy for nonprofits and government. For government, you have the tax basis. You can increase taxes or use tax revenue to provide expansion dollars. You can always do commercial loans. Both nonprofits and for-profits can do taxable bonds. And then the governments and nonprofits can do revenue bonds, and that's really what we're talking about here today. I'll go to the next slide. One of the interesting things is when we started looking at, now focusing on hospitals, when we started looking at hospital companies, we saw a couple of interesting trends. One is that when we're talking about for-profits, we see that the operating margins are significantly higher for profits than nonprofits. So in this slide, 9.7% versus 3.6%. But then when we started looking at the net margin, when you go going down the income statement, we started seeing that there's sort of a leveling out, that actually at the bottom line, nonprofits look a lot like the for-profits. And really what's happening between them, and it's interesting because typically it draws down. Your operating margin is higher, and then you pay taxes, you have interest, and by the time you hit the bottom line, your net income margin is typically lower. It's just the flip for the for-profits, and the reason is, one, they don't pay taxes, but they also are getting large amounts of investment income. And these are really, I'm talking about the really corporatized systems here, which are listed here, not the small hospital systems, but the really large ones we see around the country. Some of them multi-state systems, some of them within a state, but multi-hospital systems. The next slide. When it comes down to looking at the benefit they provide, and particularly uncompensated care, there was a recent GAO study that showed, and unfortunately they didn't do the study for Oregon, but they showed in states where there's a good mix of for-profits, non-profits, and public hospitals, what they started showing was that actually you can't really distinguish between the non-profits and the for-profits much in terms of the uncompensated care they're doing. But what really stands out is the public hospitals take the lion's share of the uncompensated, deal with the uncompensated care. Next slide is shows the importance of tax exemption overall. Access to taxes and bonds is only a part of the benefit that nonprofits get from being an exempt organization from IRS purposes. It's interesting, it's actually the largest portions of the benefit they get are within the state. So the property tax exemption, which is local, the sales tax being the next one, then the federal corporate income tax, and then tax-exempt bond financing and the charitable contributions and the state corporate income taxes is a smaller one. But what's also interesting about this is, on aggregate national terms, the exemption is very important because it basically accounts for 81% of its total operating income and almost 70% of net income.
Mr. Ray, on that slide, excuse me, it says a recent estimate by the Joint Committee on Taxation. What joint committee? Through Congress?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I don't want to get too long into this. This sort of explains the history of how we are at the current situation of financing. Basically, it was anticipated that the Hill-Burton Act, which provided construction dollars to the hospital industry nationwide, it was going to sunset in the 70s. A lot of states started creating these bond finance authorities to take advantage of taxes and bonds, which was previously just for really municipal purposes, not for non-governmental purposes. And what's interesting, actually, is, and this is something we touched on, only when we look around the country, I think there's about 6,000 hospitals, and only 500 or so roughly are rated. And about 1,200 of them actually can access the tax-exempt bond market. So it's interesting that it's kind of the system's inverted. You would think that you're providing a federal subsidy here for the hospitals that need it the most, but actually it's the 20%. Of the market that can really access this. And it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that Lynn Marie tried to say. The stronger you are, the more financial resources you have, the more you can access this market, and on a cheaper basis, too. because, you know, you'll have a higher credit rating, and that means you'll pay less interest. The other interesting thing is, with respect, there is community benefits requirements that go along with tax being an exempt organization overall, but really, in terms of the bonding component, there is no quid pro quo here. The federal government has not attached any sort of special requirement that you have to do something special. A few states have taken to themselves to enforce this. California and Washington State in particular do have some requirements that that the savings be passed on to consumers in the form of foregone price increases. The next slide, this is a very complicated one. It just shows the capital flow from the investors, who I'll point out are, you know, high marginal tax rate households, basically. They're the ones that buy these bonds because they have the greatest incentive to do so. Pension funds do not buy these bonds. People ask me that all the time because they're exempt already. They have no interest in doing that. The underwriters, one of the other things this shows is there's a lot of other market participants that have a lot of stake here, particularly the big banks. This is a very highly concentrated industry in terms of the underwriting. You can see who the top players are here, and you know, in the healthcare market as well as the overall. For one statistics, the healthcare market is roughly $40 billion a year issues in bonds. That's about 10% of the overall tax-exempt bond market, which is about $400 billion a year that's issued. And the there's other market participants involved. If you follow the dollar, some of the dollars come out to the credit rating agencies, the bond counsel firms, the financial advisors, the bond insurers. And, you know, what we see is that there's a lot of vested interest in this market and sustaining the way it works. We find it's actually quite a closed club market when you look at it place to place. And that's why we actually, in nationwide, we promote much more transparency in this market. So when we talk about conflicts of interest, this market is ridden by conflicts of interest. And if you look around, there's always some scandal. I'm not saying it's happening here, but there's been scandals all around the country. And so one of the unique things about Oregon is there is no go-to authority here. I mean, many states have a go-to authority where there's one big authority, it's professionally staffed. We find that when you're relying on counties, by counties, there's often a competition between counties. Borrowers and underwriters are able to sort of game the system. It creates a context in which there's much more conflicts of interest and potential corruption. Here in Oregon, like I said, there is no statewide authority. That's a go-to authority like there is in other states. And then, you know, again, the obligors, they're the borrowers. It's actually a small segment of the entire hospital market that can actually borrow. The next slide I just covered, say much about that. Credit means everything. I just for sake of time, I'll skip that one too. The last one, you know, the bond ratings. I thought you might be interested here, sort of what it looks like in Oregon. So in Oregon, what we see is there's only three hospital systems that are within the state that are rated. And then there's three from outside the state that are rated, interstate systems. And it's what you would expect to be the case. So looking at the out-of-state ones that are in the high-quality category, they're the ones that have big financial resources. And so this whole self-fulfilling prophecy type of thing. Kaiser at AA1, Providence at AA2, and CHI, Catholic Health Commission, is also at AA2. Going down, Cascade and Legacy at A1, and then at BBB3 is the Willamette Falls Community Hospital. Those are the rated systems in the state.
Mr. Ray, can I ask you to wrap it up because we need to hear from some other people.
Sure. I'll just say just a couple of things. You know, when we started looking at this whole thing of the investment assets, the buildup of investment assets, here when we looked at the Oregon systems as well as the interstate, we only saw three of them that have in excess of $1 billion in investment assets, Kaiser with $10.4 billion. Catholic Health Initiatives with $4.3 billion and Providence with $2.6 billion. There's another eight that have in excess of $100,000, between the $100,000 and a million. $100,000 and to a billion, between 100 million and a billion, sorry. And of those eight, only two don't have enough cushion to be floored by the bill. And so what we see here, let me just say one example, the way this is supposed to work, I believe, I didn't design the bill, is for Providence, for example, when you look at their investment assets, you subtract away their 100 days of operating expenses, the cushion, what we see is the minimum loan amount would be roughly $625 million. So what the bill would say is, all right, if you have a capital project you need to spend $300 million for, we'll draw down that $2 billion plus investment portfolio first before you go take the subsidy. But if it's going to be a very large project, then, well, go ahead, and because, you know, maybe you don't want to draw it down. We would still like to figure out a way where there's a combination of drawdown. So we don't want to encourage you to go in and take a huge loan. That's not the idea of the bill. But we also believe there's market friction there. They can't necessarily just do that. IRS rules do require you to use the money within a certain framework of time, 3 years roughly. So we think there's other market friction and IRS regs that would prevent that from happening, where you're coming in with absurd, enormous loans when you don't need it.
Okay, great. Any questions from the committee? Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple, I think, for the record. Does this bill regulate for-profit health care capital construction?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, no. This only deals with a benefit that's available to nonprofits.
Okay. A couple more questions, Madam
Chair.
Sure. Just go
ahead.
Does this regulate all hospital construction?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, it doesn't regulate construction at all. It simply deals with the financing piece on the nonprofit side. Is that helpful?
Seemed like we got the same answer to the first question.
Yeah,
it does, and maybe I didn't understand.
I'm not sure either. So
it does regulate not-for-profit hospital construction.
It establishes some rules, yes, for the for public financing of those hospitals.
Okay, Madam Chair, I. You know, I think Lynn Marie made a good point for those who don't have a rating high enough to get into the loan portfolio. I'm not sure how this addresses that at all. And
well, it doesn't. She made it clear.
Well, and it doesn't. And so I guess I don't understand. To me, Madam Chair, this looks like a solution in search of a problem. But
okay, well, we need to hear the rest of the testimony first. But Senator Metzger, you have a question.
Thank you. Mr. Ray, I just a question. I appreciate your material here. If obviously these hospital systems use this as a way of maintaining access to as low price capital as they could, if they developed facilities using a different capital strategy or higher priced financing, obviously that would add to the cost, which is why they want to use the current program. Where would you say, just based on your own financial background, is if you used higher priced financing to produce the same result, where would you anticipate, say, in a hospital system, that those costs would be absorbed? I mean, where would that's going to come out somewhere.
No, that's a
and those
question.
Costs are going to be charged to someone.
Well, the way we view this really is that the pricing is its own market. It's quite divorced from the capital costs, because hospital systems that can control a market, can control market share, will be engaged in the same pricing practices they are now, whether or not their cost of capital changes. So, I mean, in our view, it's quite divorced, one from the other.
All right. So if I can follow up on that,
sure.
Madam Chair. So you're talking about the pricing to the healthcare market.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, you have a benchmark in any organization of what your capital needs are, or what you feel that your baseline would be. And if you have additional costs, if the market's going to dictate what you can charge, then it would seem like the only other way you make it up is in expenses, either by, you know, putting tighter restrictions on staffing or materials that are available for the providing of health care. I mean, you only have two ways to adjust that bottom line. Either is by if you have the ability to charge more, and if the market's going to dictate that you can't do that. But once you think that that might actually then end up being paid for by a reduction in services or personnel who might provide health care services?
That could be one outcome. The other, you know, I mean, the reality of it is, you know, this is a market in which there's also for-profit players. And, you know, they have a higher cost of capital, but they're still able to come into markets, they're able to finance construction, they're able to provide services. I'm not making a claim that nonprofits are providing a higher level of service than for-profits. You know, it's a market in which there are for-profit players. There's an economic model that seems to be out there that you're able to provide the service regardless of sort of small frictions in your cost of capital. So,
okay, just one final one, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. But of course, one of the distinctions we make between the for-profit health provider and the nonprofit is the requirements that we place, additional requirements that we place on not-for-profits for charity care and the different measurements that are required in order to have that standing in the community. So there are trade-offs that are already made, are there not, in terms of the competition between profit and not-for-profit?
And quite honestly, I don't know what the situation here in Oregon is. But I think that's one of the slides I was addresses that point, the one that talked about the growing similarities between nonprofits and profits when you look at charity care and compensated care. This study in some of the states where they looked at where there is a mix between for-profits and nonprofits, which I don't think is so much the case here in Oregon, that they actually saw that, you know, it's almost you couldn't distinguish the behavior between them in terms of uncompensated care.
Thank you, sir.
Senator Westland.
Thank you. Thank you for coming all the way to Oregon.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I particularly empathize because I don't like those cross-country flights either. On the slide you did just hold up.
Yeah.
In your representation about uncompensated care, does that include undercompensated care as well?
I'm not sure if I understand what you mean by
we have uncompensated care,
right,
which you can have a category no payment is made.
Oh, right, okay.
Or undercompensated care where some payment is made but it is below cost.
No, I don't think that's what was included in this GAO study.
Well, I'm just concerned about this slide then, not only because it doesn't have Oregon, but there are I think uniquenesses here in Oregon. Oregon has very few government hospitals.
Right.
I don't think any, I think this is true, I don't really think we have any in our largest metropolitan area. I don't know if you consider OHSU. And then, you know, here in Oregon, we have the lowest Medicare compensation rate in the country. So you start adding some of those things. I just don't think this slide would be representative of Oregon. But I could be wrong. Anyway, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, great. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think for purposes of disclosure, I need to state the fact that I am in hospital governance in a 5-hospital system, serving on the system board as well as the one local community hospital board. Just as a point of reference, one of our community hospitals, I just happened to do the quick math, our bad debt and uncompensated care was about 15% of expenses. So your lack of data specific to Oregon, I think, is something we need to look at if we're going to make a case for this. The other question I have, Madam Chair, is, a question. What is Providence's current day's cash on hand?
I'd have to back it out here. I have it here on my computer. So 100 days. So what we saw was their investment assets, which is basically, you know, the cash. It's not plant property. It's the investment portfolio. It's not current assets like accounts receivable. That was $2.6 billion. When I took away 100 days of operating expenses, I was left with $1.2 billion. So that's an indirect way. So you got to triangulate from that. Let me just think about it for a second. So the $1.2 billion would be 100. So they have about 200 days plus. Is what I would get from this math.
Madam Chair, I did reference a hand that went up, and possibly we can get specific information.
Yeah, Providence is scheduled to testify.
Yeah.
Okay. I think they'd have a better number for you.
All right, great. Thank you. I appreciate your testimony and that you came all the way from New York. All right. Okay, we're clearly not going to get all the testimony taken today. After we hear from the two presenters of the opposition, then I'm going to start taking people who traveled more than 100 miles. So Jim Deagle, I'm not sure if I pronounced that correctly, and Spike Biggers. And we can go until 10:25 today. So what I'm going to do at 10 after 10 is call up the neutral parties. There's three of them. And then give them the last 15 minutes. So we'll have until 10:25 today. Which one of you is Spike? I just have to share with you that was my first dog's name.
Was he a good dog?
He was the most special dog I've ever had. I had him for 14 years, and I just loved him dearly. And so you already have a star next to your name coming in front of the committee, so thank you.
I'll try and do as well as your dog, man.
All right. Thank you. So if you'll introduce your full name for the record, please.
I'm Spike Biggers. I reside in Redmond, Oregon. And I'm here as a former chair of the board of Cascade Healthcare Community. And that is, by the way, the parent company of St. Charles Medical Center Bend and St. Charles Medical Center Redmond. I also served as the chair on the finance committee of Cascade Healthcare Community. And I'm also a former board member of what used to be Central Oregon District Hospital, which merged with St. Charles Medical Center to form Cascade Healthcare Community. So that's the basis that I come here.
Okay.
Chair Walker.
Okay.
And good morning, Chair Walker and members of the committee. Good morning, Senator Westland.
I was thinking you probably know this guy down here.
Yes, I had a dog named Ben once.
It was the worst dog I ever had.
Yeah.
You have a lot of training problems with that dog?
Worse than ticks on a junkyard dog, I think, is what you used one time. All right, well, this is great.
If it's okay with Chair Walker, I would like to lead off with our presentation
okay.
this morning.
Okay, please do.
Again, Chair Walker and members of the committee, my name is Jim Deagle. I'm the president and CEO of Cascade Healthcare Community. I also reside in the great city of Redmond, Oregon. I've been in Central Oregon about 13 years, was first recruited to the former Central Oregon District Hospital as its administrator, and then was integral in the merger between St. Charles and Bend and CODH in Redmond back in 2000. Cascade Healthcare Community owns, as Spike said, is the parent corporation to both St. Charles Medical Center in Bend and Redmond now. We also manage Pioneer Memorial Hospital in Prineville and Mountain View Hospital District in Madras. And we're part of the Central Oregon Hospital Network, which, in addition to our four facilities, includes the Frontier Rural Hospitals in John Day, Burns, Lakeview, and also Columbia Medical Center up in the Dalles. And so we're very regionally focused. And as you can imagine, if you include our referral areas, we cover about 33,000 square miles in central and eastern Oregon. So a relatively large area that our organization serves. We have 2,600 caregivers. That's what we refer to all of our employees in our organization, regardless of the job title that they have. And we're served by a 11-member board of directors, 10 members of whom are volunteers, and this includes Mr. Biggers, who took time off from his busy day to join me over here today. I will not address at length Senate Bill 614. I'll just talk about a couple of items. As Senator Westland knows and the constituents that he serves in our region, we're one of the fastest-growing regions, obviously, in the Pacific Northwest. The community of Bend landed in The Economist magazine about a month ago under a title called Booming Bend, which is just what we need, more international folks moving to our area. And as part of a rapidly growing community and health system, we take careful pains to make sure that we plan appropriately for the right deployment of resources in our communities and also in the region, the entire region that we serve. I won't address the financial impacts that the proponents of the legislation spoke to a few minutes ago. I'll let Mr. Biggers address that. I wanted to address two particular areas of concern to me. Number one is the intended restrictive use of the increased certificate of need requirements for us, specifically certain not-for-profit hospitals here in the state of Oregon. I need to go on record and say that I do not oppose the CM process in general. I would say, however, that I don't believe that it has been effective historically in the state of Oregon. And applying it to a narrow group of hospitals or health systems in the state without expanding the entire review and health planning process to the freestanding ambulatory care environment, to imaging centers, to investor-owned facilities, etc., I think is problematic, and from my perspective, disenfranchises and creates significant problem for areas that are attempting to plan and meet community need. I mentioned that it should be expanded, and one of the things I think is important to mention, Chair Walker, is at Cascade we take very careful pains to ensure that when we plan and decide to construct facilities, we're really meeting community need. Now, I prefaced early on that the significant growth in the region is creating a significant expectation and pressure on the organization. But we also use a subcommittee of the Board of Directors called the Planning and Development Committee that is populated not only with some members of the Board of Directors, but also other lay members in the community, not only in Bend and Redmond, but also Madras, Prineville. We have representatives who drive over from Burns, from Warm Springs and other communities, so that as we plan as a health system, we're including the entire region and we're really relying on the community to validate how we're going to invest in our facilities and expend our capital and our precious resources. I think that's important to note. And I would appeal to this committee that placing a very restrictive requirement on certificate of need for organizations like ours is really a disproportionate disadvantage for us. And so I would ask for consideration about that. I also want to talk just very briefly about the impact of delays. Last year in Central Oregon, we had a variety of construction projects that were going on. If we increase the oversight of how we plan and construct and deploy resources, which results in delay, and we all know that when you add layers of oversight, it does have a tendency to delay the ability to get into projects. Last year alone, we experienced about a 2% inflation rate per month with construction costs. And in one of our projects, as we redesigned the project because of a changing immediate need in the community, we continued to watch the price escalate for those particular projects as time went on. It was very, very frustrating. One of the dilemmas we face as an organization right now. We're in the final stages. We're about halfway through adding about 12 labor and delivery rooms and 12 neonatal intensive care unit beds to our facility. When we bring that facility online in 2008, about mid-year 2008, we will be at capacity once again. And again, that's a phenomena of the growth in the region. And my concern is if we have restrictive requirements in terms of how we get CN and how we get financing, we're going to always be behind the curve in Central Oregon. And when you can't bring facilities online fast enough, not only do you hear from patients, you hear from the community, you hear from physicians, you hear from caregivers, it's very hard to defend. And then lastly, I would say there is a component of the legislation that requires that any construction or major activity planned in excess of $10 million requires a CN process. I can tell you for our organization, $10 million is a small project. And I don't know too many projects that are significant to our organization that are under $10 million. And so I just have some heartburn with certain provisions of this particular bill. And Chair Walker, members of the committee, that's all I have to say, and I would defer to my board member, Spike Biggers.
Okay, we'll hear from Mr. Biggers, and we'll open
thank
up
you.
For questions.
Thank you, Chair Walker and Senators. I appreciate being able to be here today as a volunteer board member. I wanted to focus a little bit on my experience on the Finance Committee and as a board member and the impacts of this bill. We looked at this bill and had a financial advisor who we consult with when we go out to the market for debt, and that was a gentleman related with Morgan Stanley, does a lot of good work for us. And back in 2005, we had we floated a bonds for about $125 million. It wasn't very much earlier than that we didn't have a lot of debt. But due to the increased growth and needs for health care in Central Oregon, and health care has an insatiable appetite for cash, we have found, and so we have gone to the markets for that and utilized tax-exempt bonds to do that. Looking at the figures of how this bill would have impacted that $125 million, it's a little bit staggering. We're presently rated, as Mr. Ray mentioned earlier, A1, on bond ratings. Bond ratings are very, very significant when you consider capital projects or anything that impacts your bottom line. One of the first questions that comes out is, how will this impact our bond rating? We have been advised that if we were restricted to 100 days cash on hand before we did this, our bond rating would drop to a Baa3. That's just a step above junk bonds. And if that happened, our increased cost of capital would be about 153 basis points, or 1.53%. That would be about a 38% increase in our cost of capital. That goes directly to the bottom line. It's got to come from someplace. And that would, over time, would cost us about $15.9 million by the time these bonds are retired. There is another implication that this bond would have, that if you fell into that category, you would not have access to any bond insurance. That is significant also in reducing the cost of your bonds. We are not maintaining investments and so forth to go out and purchase things that are not healthcare related and that sort of thing. You have to have a positive bottom line, and when you look at Moody's ratings and so forth, as I recall, and I don't have this in writing, it's on the top of my head, it's at least a 3.9% minimum operating margin to maintain an A rating. And it doesn't take a lot of fluctuation to take you from, a targeted 5% down to a 3.9%. There's some significant things that can happen. Looking at what our hospital has experienced, I apologize that I do not have the specific figures in front of me to quote you of what our charity and bad debt care trend has been in the past 3 or 4 years, but it has been significant, and as a percentage of our bottom line. And so when we look at these things, as Senator Metzger mentioned earlier or questioned earlier, when you increase the cost of capital significantly, it is a direct hit to the bottom line. And I have operated and am familiar with various financing over the years. My former career was in agricultural financing. I'm also somewhat familiar with cooperatives and things like that. And whenever you restrict things a great deal, you suddenly upset the balance of things. You can't have a break even. There is no such thing as a break even, so to speak. You either operate at a profit or a loss, and you become very vulnerable. And so my closing thoughts on this would be that this bill would significantly influence the cost of capital and be very costly to Oregon in general, because of the work that not-for-profits do and are charged with. There's one other point that I'd like to make, and that references Section 8 of the bill with filing statements of economic interest with the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission. While we are not a public hospital system necessarily, in that we don't have any tax-based authority or anything like that, we do look to volunteers in the community that have some business expertise or other expertise that would be good board members. And when you start requiring these registrations and so forth, it does impact who will step up to the plate and serve on those types of boards. You realize that there's a great deal of time and effort that goes into some of these things. Some of these people are very busy and contribute significantly to boards of directors. So I think Senator Morris alluded to this in his opening on it also. So with that, I would close my remarks unless you have further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Biggers. I would note that the Statement of Economic Interest form is an annual form at
Correct.
This point. It's being proposed to go to a 4 times a year. But it's not that difficult of a form, and there are some things you can exclude from it, not many, but it's actually not that difficult. It takes time out of my day, which I don't like either.
Right.
But
I didn't see any of that in the bill as I
okay.
scanned through it, but I'm not a professional at reading Senate bills.
Yeah, well, I think that's actually probably the least onerous part of this bill that you need to be worried about. But Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Federal law requires statements of conflict of interest, and I think we need to make that known.
Okay.
In fact, I just filled one out last week.
Yeah. As do we
in requirement of law.
We do within our own board. We require that, and also annually on our finance committee and so forth. We do
audit committee
and the audit committee. We do require that also.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I would like to make reference to one point that has surfaced in our discussions looking at financial statements and statements with respect to community charitable care that we provide. And what we discovered was that the accounting standards really don't, when you conform to the generally accepted accounting standards, it doesn't accurately reflect the true charity care that is provided by not-for-profits. And so when we look at the data that has been prepared from a national perspective, picking out some states, what I suspect is that you'd have to drill down into those financial statements in order to get the true charity care that is provided. And I see you nodding your head. What elaboration you could make from your perspective, I think, would be helpful as well.
Yeah, Senator, I think you are correct. And Spike, you may recall that Steve Evans frequently talks about how they do comparative analysis and how they recommend that you appropriately account for your charity care and your bad debt and your deductions from revenue, as you referenced, Senator. And I think all of us clearly, and I know that this is important to Senator Westland, all of us clearly understand that as charitable organizations, as not-for-profit hospitals and health systems, we do have a sacred trust with our communities that we serve, and that charity care and bad debt is an expectation in exchange for that charitable purpose. And I think in our organization, we continue to really look at how do we more accurately reflect that? How do we ensure that we're granting all of the charity care that that we should be, etc.? And so I would say that the attention that has been laid at the feet of not-for-profit systems has clearly caused a conscious shift, at least in those that lead those organizations, to ensure that we're meeting the community's expectation, and that we're accountable for that, and we're transparent and disclosing. And I know transparency is very important to Senator Westland. He's impressed that upon me, and he has my attention on that, too. Chair Walker.
I think you'll find that is a big issue in this legislative assembly. Senator Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of comments. The first one is that the organization these gentlemen represent, I mean, notwithstanding the fact they've saved my life three times in the last 5 years, and I know that's a great consternation to most members of the committee and half the audience. The
conflict of interest statement.
Yeah. I declare a conflict of interest on that. But they represent, a specific type of challenge to our healthcare delivery system. I mean, they're in, depending on the, they're a single region system, and they're in a region that, depending on the numbers, is the sixth fastest or seventh fastest growing area in the country. I mean, that presents a specific set of challenges that I think they have very well articulated. I mean, these guys very legitimately have to be looking out over the second horizon to anticipate the physical bricks and sticks needs of our community. But there are other communities. Yours is the prime example, where you have two hospitals that have functionally decided to trade sides of the freeway at a cost of $500-700 million, only some portion of which I think you could make legitimately serve the community need. And then you have Portland, where the battle is over market share for commercial payers. And this is why I made the comment, Mr. Ray, about our uncompensated or low Medicaid and extraordinarily low Medicare reimbursement rates. The impetus is to move into areas with higher commercial pay, because commercial pay subsidizes Medicare, which these individuals, all the hospitals, are to receive the benefit of these tax-exempt funds, are required to take Medicare and Medicaid or undercompensated care. Having said that, I mean, this is a very difficult issue for me, and You know, when I heard Mr. Ray and Ms. Kreider in their remarks, you know, what I heard was just a screaming need, for which I absolutely agree, is a more rational process to evaluate community need and capital expenditures all throughout Oregon that is broader than just hospitals. It's surgery centers, it's imaging, it's all the things that we're spending, you know, so much money on. So, anyway, this is a difficult issue for me, Madam Chair, and I knew I was going someplace with this, but I...
And we still don't know where it was.
Well, I think it's that there has to be a rational process. I mean, this is an exaggeration, but these guys can't build fast enough. There are other hospitals that are building, you know, for market share. And there's differences between our systems, the geographic locations, and the needs of the communities. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Gentlemen, I'd ask you to respond, but I'm not sure there was a question there, more of a thought about what's in his mind. So if we had more time, I'd have you analyze that. Senator Westland is very experienced on health care issues, and we appreciate his comments today. And I appreciate that you came all the way from Redmond. Thank you.
It's our pleasure.
Okay. We have about 15 more minutes for public testimony before I take the neutral parties, which I think are important. So I'm going to really have to limit some testimony here. Janice Thompson, do you want to come forward? And then I have a note that Ellen Penny had to leave. Did Ellen come back? Okay, is there anyone else to testify in favor? Because Janice is our last proponent. Okay. If you change your mind, come on up. Janice, tell us who you are and give us some testimony, please.
Good morning. I'm Janice Thompson with the Money and Politics Research Action Project, an organization that's generally interested in government accountability and transparency. And more specifically this morning, really just trying to give you an update on some parallels between Senate Bill 641 and some activities and recommendations from the Interim Ethics Work Group of the Oregon Law Commission. Specifically in Senate Bill 494. So my comments focus strictly on the conflict of interest aspects of Senate Bill 641,
okay,
and we'll leave to others to hash out the pros and cons of the other aspects of the bill regarding the regulation of financing of these facilities.
Do you mean 641 or 614?
614. My apologies.
That's
reverse
those fine. Numbers. I just want to make sure.
No,
I'm on the
absolutely.
Same page.
My error in reversing
okay.
those numbers. So, to reference, the Law Commission, put out a report that accompanied its big package of bills, and just want to just quickly read from that. Conflicts of interest are ubiquitous in the public sector. Most, if not all, aspects of government ethics law deal in some manner with actual or potential conflicts between individual public officials and the broader public interest. Such conflicts cannot be avoided without depriving government of the knowledge and abilities of too many of its citizens. On the other hand, they cannot be tolerated if they lead to self-interested conduct. So that was, I think, a good capsulization of the discussion of the Interim Ethics Work Group on this whole conflict of interest questions, and it reflects goals it was trying to achieve in Senate Bill 494. Specifically in relationship to this bill, Senate Bill 494, for example, removes the current exemption for when a conflict of interest involves a public official with an affiliated 501c organization. So in other words, that aspect of the bill before you today is consistent with one aspect of Senate Bill 494 that covers, a broader range of conflict of interest improvements that the Law Commission is recommending for consideration.
Okay.
So I just wanted to, point out that there are some parallels here, that, this bill is not heading off in some direction that's, significantly different from this parallel discussion. So this is just kind of my main interest, is informing you of that. Another quick comment in terms of the statements of economic interest is that there are some recommendations also from the Law Commission that are reflected, I believe, in Senate Bill 10, which is moving forward, that do some streamlining and clarifying of the SEI forms.
Right, that's what I referenced.
Right. Exactly.
Bill moves forward. Okay.
So, again, my comments are just strictly on the conflict of interest aspects and to just point out that they're kind of consistent with some parallel legislation and the discussion of the Law Commission on this topic.
Okay.
With regards to 501c organizations.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and that's why I said I think that's the least onerous provision
right.
of this bill. Okay, any questions? All right, thank you, Ms. Thompson. All right, I'd like to take some of the opponents who came from a distance. That would be Chuck Hawley from Providence. And let's see, we've got two people from Legacy, Charles Plimpton and then Tricia. Okay, then Charles, and then Mark Perry. You're also more than 100 miles. So Charles Plimpton and Mark Perry, come on up and join our guest at the table, please.
Thank you, Chair Walker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Charles Hawley. I'm the Vice President of Public Affairs for Providence Health and Services. I'm going to shorten my remarks today. I've got a longer statement I'd be glad to give to committee staff, but in the interest of time, I'll just keep this quick. Just by reference, Providence provided 2.4 million hospital outpatient visits last year, 300,000 inpatient days of hospital services, but more importantly, we provided charity care services to over 50,000 Oregonians, and our costs of providing charity care services in terms of uncompensated care amounted to nearly $55 million. That's an increase over $35 million was our number in 2004. Our total community benefit expenditures amounted to almost $126 million. Which is a 14.6% increase. I'm pleased to be here today to share with you our strong concerns and objections to this legislation. It was somewhat of a challenge preparing my remarks because it was difficult to know really what was the problem we were trying to solve, as Senator Westland indicated. We think this financing system has served Oregonians well. It has created lower cost facilities in virtually every part of this state, and lower cost than if they had been financed with debt issues at taxable rates. But let me go beyond that and address some of the substantive reasons beyond it that underlie our objection to this legislation. We believe that if this bill were enacted into law, it would raise the cost of health care and delay the provision of needed services by placing unwise and untested limits on tax-exempt financing for only not-for-profit hospitals. First of all, Section 2 of the legislation expressly prohibits the use of tax-exempt financing unless a hospital first spends down its cash reserves to a level specified in the legislation. Now, as we prepared our remarks, we anticipated that some proponents of the measure would assert that many providers simply have what they would characterize as too much cash on their balance sheet. And so this would cause them to suggest that, as this measure would require, that hospitals would have to spend down these reserves before being eligible. Rating agencies, first of all, I would say these are interesting arguments. They ignore the harsh reality of the financial markets and how they assign risk and assign ratings. Rating agencies, you've heard something about that today, used by bond purchasers to assess the risk of these investments, understandably equate reduced cash reserves with more risk. Risk translates into lower bond ratings, and lower rated bonds trading in a financial market carry a higher interest rate. I won't go into all the detail, it will be in my written remarks, but just to point out that the median days cash on hand for a bond issued in 2006 on behalf of a Fitch AA rated nonprofit hospital was 230 days. It's also very clear that the market is unforgiving. When hospital liquidity slips, bond ratings tumble, and that can have an immediate impact not only on future debt issues but on existing debt, which is often financed in the market under short-term variable rates. The net result of this bill, if it's enacted into law, will be higher interest expense for providers on the fewer projects that can be financed with tax-exempt debt. Now, as this increased interest expense is passed along to healthcare purchasers and consumers alike, it simply makes healthcare less affordable. This reality is not lost on our boards or management of nonprofit hospitals who have a tremendous fiduciary responsibility. Replacing their judgment and the expectations of the bond market regarding the adequacy of cash reserves with this formula is unwise. I do have a document that we'll pass out today.
Okay.
That is entitled The Importance of Cash for Not-for-Profit Hospitals. I think it's prepared by Moody's Investor Services and really details this issue nicely. The other thing I would just say, it appears that the language in Section 5 would mandate that virtually all projects funded with tax-exempt debt first be required to obtain a certificate of need, even if the projects financed don't otherwise merit that level of review. Now, it's important for this committee to note that a single bond issue often represents an aggregation of many projects and facilities in order to keep overall financing costs at a minimum. As a result, a bond issue will likely include projects where the legislature has not mandated certificate of need review, and the practical effect of this provision is to delay the financing and construction of these projects. As you've heard already, and I won't repeat this, but in today's construction environment, delays equate to increased costs, with some projects no longer being financially feasible. Now, some may suggest that this measure, that a certificate of need should be required as a cost containment mechanism to prevent the construction of facilities that they believe necessitate a review, even though you as a legislative body haven't mandated one. Providence believes that a discussion about what projects should be subjected to certificate of need review should not be tied to this legislation. This legislation does not affect all hospitals and would have no impact on for-profit institutions. And furthermore, it raises a number of implementation questions. In conclusion, I would just simply say that passing this bill will result in the following outcomes. Downgrading of bond ratings for many of Oregon's not-for-profit hospitals. 2, higher interest expense for the bonds that can be sold, resulting in only larger returns for Wall Street investors. 3, higher costs passed on to healthcare purchasers and consumers, making insurance less affordable. 4, some projects becoming financially unfeasible, resulting in fewer services to meet the increasing community needs, much like what we've just heard about, to say nothing about the lost economic impact of jobs for healthcare and construction workers. And finally, increased financial pressure on Oregon's hospital providers, except for for-profit hospitals, which are unaffected by this legislation. Because, quite frankly, if the burden of tax-exempt financing is greater than the benefit that it provides, providers will increasingly be forced to issue taxable debt, which has a perverse effect on financial performance and the services that your constituents need. In closing, I would just like to thank the members of the committee for your thoughtful consideration of my remarks. I've got a longer statement that we'll make copies of and enter into the record.
Okay, thank you. We've got about 3 minutes left. Sir, you are?
I'm Mark Perry from Portland Adventist Medical Center. Thank you, Senator Walker, and members for allowing us to speak to this issue. I've been with the hospital about 16 years, either as controller or VP of finance, and it is a struggle every year to come up with a bottom line that we maintain our bond issue, our bond rating. I wanted to talk to you specifically about a service that we provide that will be impacted by increasing costs, not only staffing costs, but also bond costs. We do have a facility that is a new building project that's underway that will expand our ED by 100%. So we'll be at 33 beds versus the 18 beds we're at today. That is a direct demand that we're trying to meet from our community. We're at over capacity, and we need to build this facility. We serve a lot of economically depressed area in the city of Portland in the southeast section. And there's one particular service that we provide 44 beds of mental health, hospital mental health beds. We are the single largest mental health hospital provider in the state of Oregon. This year, or in 2006, we lost $3 million on a fully allocated cost basis for our mental health program. So any cost increase puts pressure on those services that aren't producing a bottom line to the facility. We also have overflow in our med-surg beds, and we have 2 to 3 psych patients holding in our ED. So we are overwhelmed with mental health issues. Over about a third of our census is dedicated to mental health. And as you know, there's a crisis in the state of Oregon in terms of mental health care. Our uncompensated care has doubled in the last 4 years due to the demise of the Oregon Health Plan, and so we're seeing lots of areas that are attacking our bottom line, and this is just one more of those in a very practical sense. So first, we're cut off from tax-exempt financing. It just adds to the cost picture and puts pressure on those services that we can no longer afford to maintain.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Very quick question.
Well, just a clarification for the record, like I say, it was Senator Cruz that indicated this is a problem in search of a cure.
Thank you.
And I'd just like to say, I do think there's a problem here. The issue before us is how do we equitably craft a solution that benefits the entire state. That's where I think we are.
Okay, I agree. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm going to exercise some discretion here. I'm going to give 2 minutes to the southern part of the state, which is my region. So I'll have the Peace Health representative come up. I'm sorry, sir, but you only have about 2 minutes.
That's fine.
And if you have written testimony, you can submit it.
I will do that. Chairman Walker, members of the committee, I'm Roshan Preek. I'm the Treasury Director of Peace Health. What you've heard already in testimony in opposition, I agree with that. You may be interested to know that if we took the amount of extra capital costs that we would have to pay if this bill were to come into law, that would be about $200 million over the life of the bonds that we currently have outstanding and what we have planned for this coming fall. That's a big number. And that money has to come from somewhere. Peace Health is about quality, access, patient satisfaction, and affordability. This bill works against all of those. I don't know how much more strongly I could state the case that if there has to be some solution, as Senator Westland, Senator Metzger, Senator Morris have all pointed out, this is not the vehicle to do it. This is a poorly written bill. Let me point out just one more thing. If I had $200 million of cash and I borrowed $100 million, I'm a 2-to-1. I can't borrow more than $10 million. If I borrowed $200 million and I had $200 million of cash, then I'm at 1-to-1. I'd have to borrow more to be in compliance with the bill. If I wanted to pay more in interest, that doesn't make any sense at all. It's perverse effect of this bill. The certificate of need provisions, I'm sorry, that is just going to add more costs to this system. It's haphazard. It treats different market participants unfairly, and I think that's been pointed out. And if there's one thing that I could say about it is that the certificate of need process is nationwide being phased out and not increased. And this would go the opposite direction of that, and it would treat different people in different ways. Did I make my 2 minutes?
Yeah, you did. Yeah. And that's a nice segue because we're going to hear from Jana Fussell next to talk about certificate of need. Thank you, sir. Jana Fussell and Ingo Deckert, could you come forward, please? I've got you down as neutral. Okay, we can go till 10:25.
No.
No, Ms. Deckard, I want to hear from you first, okay. And then we're going to take Ms. Fussell.
For the record, Inga Deckard, I'm the legislative director for the state treasurer. The treasurer has an interest in this bill because he is the appointing authority for the five members of the Oregon Facilities Authority Board, the OFA board, and the debt management division in his office provides staff to OFA also. And Laura Lockwood McCall, who is the director of that division, was here earlier. Unfortunately, she had an appointment and was not able to stay. OFA has not taken a position on this bill. I can't really say that we're neutral. I didn't check one of the boxes because they haven't taken a position yet on this bill. They're actually meeting this afternoon, and we'll be reviewing this.
Well, I checked neutral for you.
Okay. Because
that means you're neither for nor against. You're sort of out there.
But
I needed to know. And so that's what you're telling me now. You're meeting this afternoon?
Right. The authority is meeting this afternoon. They will be receiving a legislative update, including an update on this piece of legislation, and we'll be taking a formal position at that time. So I didn't want to check a box and get out in front of them. We have heard from one member of the authority who had some real concerns about this legislation. Most of the concerns that we've heard from him and just others who are interested in this and have contacted our office are the same concerns that you've heard here. Mm-hmm. Increase in the cost of health care, the restrictions in the formula being too restrictive as far as the 100 days and the $10 million and what that may do to negatively impact credit ratings for the hospitals. And I have three reports here, actually, one from each of the three credit rating agencies that relate to U.S. not-for-profit hospitals and their cash on hand and kind of what their balance sheet needs to look like to receive certain credit ratings. So I can make copies of these and provide them to the committee if you're interested.
I think that would be extremely helpful, Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Inga. So I would just like to kind of get very specific now. You're talking about the Facilities Authority. I want to talk about the Treasurer's Office yourself now, because this bill's been out there. I want to know, does the Treasurer agree or disagree that this legislation would, in fact, lower hospital credit rating and would have a negative effect on their ability to borrow and would require a higher cost of lending and a lower rating on bonds if this were to be in effect? What is the Treasurer's view on that argument?
Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, not being healthcare policy experts and knowing what it takes out there, just given the numbers that we have seen here in the reports that we have, he does have some concerns definitely about how this could impact credit rating negatively. It looks just from, and I just have a Standard & Poor's survey here from about 550 nonprofit healthcare hospitals in the U.S. for their 2006 numbers, their cash on hand, the median was 160 days. And when you look at to receive what would be a high enough credit rating where OFA would give financing, the cash on hand is well over 200 days. So, I mean, there are definitely some concerns about the formula and how restrictive it is. One of the other concerns that he had, which was also discussed earlier, was on the conflict of interest provision. And I know that someone testified to that and the Law Commission's work. I mean, we much prefer, in Senate Bill 494, I believe it is, the Law Commission's work to include nonprofits, and the way that that's laid out from our perspective is much more clear than the language that's currently in the bill. The proponents of this legislation came and met with us early on to hear some of the issues that we may have and have been working with us, and we very much appreciate that. The conflict of interest, language that came in on the amendment still wasn't where we would like to see it. We'd like to see the Law Commission, that type of language, and also in Chapter 244, not in the OFA chapter, we believe is an inappropriate place, and I think they'll continue to work on that piece, but that still doesn't address some of the other credit rating issues.
Mm-hmm. I think what Senator Metzger wants is a letter from the Treasurer. I mean, I would want that. We see that. That's why we passed a rainy day fund, because our bond rating was in the tank, because we have no savings. So I think, what we'd like to see is perhaps take a look at those reports, mm-hmm. and see how bond ratings are impacted based on a hospital's reserves.
Sure.
Just one final comment. Thank you, Madam Chair, and that would be helpful. I think that would be exactly what I think the committee would find helpful. And as the Senate member on the State Treasurer's Debt Policy Advisory Committee, and just point out that in the report that we just issued and made a presentation to the Senate Revenue Committee on, just as a measuring stick, when we do our bonding, for example, for transportation projects, and as you heard the co-chair in putting together the budget for the, for consideration by this legislature and changing some of the bonding level from the original governor's budget is to keep in mind what that debt service is. And with treasure and with our transportation projects, we have a rule of thumb that cash on hand, you know, has to be four times the amount that we would go to in terms of, you know, bonding certain projects. And so when you think of, you know, cash on hand, whether you know, make a nexus to healthcare facilities or whatever, the standard is pretty high in order to maintain a solid bond rating on that. And I think we should apply those same type of cautionary rules in bonding that we do for state government and when we offer it or make that available to our not-for-profit, you know, partners. That, you know, perhaps the language in the bill is way too restrictive for a positive bond rating.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to hear from Ms. Fussell now. You've got 5 minutes. And Ms. Fussell, I want you to answer one question for me first. We had some testimony from our last witness that nationally the certificate of need process is going away, is being phased out. I don't think I agree with that. Could you respond?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jana Fussell, and I'm here today on behalf of the Department of Human Services, which administers the CN program, and I coordinate the program for the Public Health Department's Office of Community Health and Health Planning. Madam Chair, to answer your question, no, I don't think that that's an accurate characterization. Nationally, 36 states plus the District of Columbia have CN programs, and Oregon's had its program since 1971. Programs vary greatly between states, and so there's change in what's covered and what isn't in states. Nationally, we rank very close to the bottom on the scope of our program. We cover only new hospitals as defined in statute, and then new nursing facility services and facilities. So it's a pretty narrow program.
Okay. All right. I thought that was more accurate. Could you, you've got some written testimony here. Can you just summarize? It appears that you have some issues, administrative issues with the bill. You want to just point those out to
yes.
the committee, and then we can review this
Madam Chair,
later.
Yes. We understand that there will be amendments introduced to narrow what is covered under Senate Bill 614. The bill as currently drafted is unclear on exactly what projects are subject to CN review under its provisions. And the program believes that this language possibly includes some facilities serving elderly individuals that are beyond the reasonable scope of CN. We ask that the final bill be clearly drafted so that it is very clear in statute what types of projects must obtain a CN from the program. As we see the key policy issue presented by this bill as relates to the Certificate of Need program, we believe that the question is, do we need to increase CN's scope of authority as a regulatory approach to control health care costs and improve quality, or do we continue to rely on the marketplace to achieve these results? If the legislature decides to increase the scope of authority of the CN program, is Senate Bill 614 the best mechanism to achieve that goal? And so I'm available for any questions you may have.
Okay. Committee, do you have any questions? I think we've been presented with a lot of information today. I have no intention of moving this bill. I mean, clearly the Dash 1 amendment didn't get us where we need to be, and I think we have a little bit of work to do on this one. So I appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry we've run out of time. We won't be able to take any further testimony. We did get quite a few folks on the witness stand. If you have written testimony, you may submit it to the committee through the administrator. She will distribute it to the rest of the committee. We're happy to take continuing testimony. I don't know where we're going to go with this bill yet, but it's not dead in the common parlance around the building, but it needs some help. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 614. And committee, unless we have anything else to talk about, we're adjourned. Thank you for staying.